A teacher named Faith, talking to Nicole Mullis, columnist, playwright, author, journalist. Oh, my.
Don't forget mom.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that. I was working up to that. Yeah, yeah, the most important job of all. So how do you juggle all of these many important jobs?
I honestly couldn't tell you. Basically, I'm primarily my kid's mom, and I travel around with a laptop in my car at all times, and anytime there's a spare minute, that's what I'm doing.
Now, what's this I hear about that laptop is called Little Brother?
Yes, it's kind of a joke. One day I had the laptop in the back of the car, and we stopped. You know, the kids move their stuff around or whatever. We stopped short, and the laptop pitched forward, and as anyone who is on a budget will tell you, it was just horrifying to me. And so I jokingly said, let's seatbelt it into the car.
Oh,
and that's what it became, the Little Brother. So
okay.
I have two girls, a boy, and a computer.
when you start using a car seat for it, we know we're in trouble.
Yes, that would be bad.
So tell me, Nicole, about your journey as a writer.
I've always wanted to write. It's kind of a cliche, but it's true. I think I was just thinking this morning, the first gift my parents ever got me that I remember was this little typewriter, and it had like six words on it, like I, you, love, we. And I think I created every sentence you could out of that typewriter.
Ooh, that's a good discipline, I think.
And I grew up reading the newspaper with my father. And actually, I was a huge Mitch Albom fan. I was a huge Detroit Tiger fan, which is why I was reading the sports section. And I started reading it right around the time that he became a columnist there. And
so Detroit Free Press was
yeah, we were a free press family. We were a free press family. I thought I wanted to be a sports columnist. I think I always knew I wanted to write fiction stories, and I also think there was a practical part of me that said, that recognized that.
And you were a sports columnist at one point, were you not?
I worked in sports department, sports stringing, which at the time I was doing it, it was a completely male-dominated department. So I did a lot of sailboat race coverage.
Okay.
But I did some fun stuff too, and I found out really quickly that although I love baseball and I love sports, I liked the drama that was going on with those sports. I liked the stories, which is why I think I was attracted to the column part of it. I have no mind, and certainly not the mind that you should have to be a beat writer, which is latching on to those statistics and remembering who was playing second in 1963 during, you know, that wasn't me.
Yeah, yeah.
I just liked the drama of it. And
I'm there with you. I love sports stories, but the statistics...
Oh, yeah.
No,
I could watch
how.
A sports movie at the drop of a hat. I am all in.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I love my Tigers that way. But when it came to other sports, and I'm working five times as hard to keep those stats together, recognizing that, you know, there's a mind for this. There's a person, you know, like, for example, my son, who absorbs stats and thinks about them and spits them out without needing to check his notebook.
Yeah.
So.
But, you know, I've always found that even if you're not a big sports fan, it's a story of of a hero's quest, which really is the basis for all classic stories.
I completely agree. And especially in a game of baseball where the failure rate is astronomical, it really translates to me to almost everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm one of those people who could watch a ball game for 6 hours and appreciate the drama of it and what's going on and that fight with yourself and how it's an individual thing, but also a group thing. I don't know. I could go on and on. So that's the part I loved.
Yeah.
But wasn't going to be, you know, the beat writer that I think I went to school for.
But you've also written all these other columns. So tell us about the other ones and you're to this day, Battle Creek Inquirer columnist. Yes. Once a week.
Yes. That came about. So I got married and I had these children and I,
along with the laptop.
Along with the laptop. No, not the laptop right away.
That came later.
That truly came in birth order. No, I had my children, and I really was invested in my kids. My husband and I both were. And I was a stay-at-home mom, and I believe every mom needs to do what they need to do. We were lucky that we were able to do this. And but I don't think, in a way, it was as big of a sacrifice for me as maybe another person, because I had this writing life. And as soon as those babies were down, I was on our computer or with a notebook. I mean, it wasn't really fair. So yes, I worked very hard, but they sort of fed into each other, taking care of the kids also in a way took care of the writing, taking care of the writing also took care of the kids. So I was very blessed and very fortunate in that respect. And I was looking to get back out there. It was kind of scary. I wrote some pieces and gave it to the Inquirer, and they came back and said they were interested in me being a columnist. I think it was like once a month on a Friday. But I remember, I think the first column I wrote was about them asking for my resume. And at the time, I had no work contacts that knew me by my married name. So I'm like digging up people, giving them my maiden name. And so I kind of wrote about that experience of what it meant to have a resume, the concept of resuming something. What I felt like was that I was legally dead for 7 years, according to the government. But that was my first column. And then the papers changed a lot. I think I've worked under 10 or 12 different editors, and I'm still here.
Yeah, that's good training, too. A lot of different editors, and surely everyone had their own style.
They were all wonderful, and I was pretty obsessive about what I was doing. So it started out as family life, and then I think in 2010, right before my family went to Canada for a couple years, they offered me the regular Sunday spot in Life and Arts, and I've been there ever since, so.
And wasn't there a column in there somewhere about parenting, being a mom?
I did some freelance work. I worked for MichiganMoms.com. I wrote a blog for them. I worked at Port Huron as their mommy or parenting columnist. But you know, the papers have changed so much. So some of these things actually all of them just died quiet deaths.
Columnists are what now, becoming bloggers?
Yeah, and I never really got into the blogging thing. I think I had way too much training to the idea that there wasn't an editor involved, that there wasn't a process, that you got done with it, you put it out there. I couldn't bend my mind around it. So,
and what's your column at the Inquirer called?
Called it Developing Laugh Lines. So it's basically humor, family life.
And available online too, right?
Oh yeah, it's available online. And actually I started my website, so I'll carry links to the Sunday columns on Facebook as well. Actually, I got a little lecture about not being on Facebook, so I am on Facebook now.
yes. And plays. You're a playwright as well. And reading your book, A Teacher Named Faith, I could sense that playwright influence. You love dialogue.
I love
dialogue. And probably also being a newspaper writer makes your copy spare and get to the facts. And there's some, which makes it also very quick moving. It's a page turner.
Yes. Thank you.
So talk about your playwriting.
Playwriting was a complete accident. I was almost graduating from Michigan State University, and I definitely loved literature and playwriting, but when the university, they were very separate and I couldn't afford to dual major. So, very wonderful man named Dr. Stan Soffin made a little favor with the English department, and I took a Shakespeare class my senior year. We had to write an adaptation of the closet scene in Hamlet, and so I worked on it. It was interesting to me, and when I got my paper back, he was very harsh on these adaptations, the professor was, and he had this way of giving our grades back, and he would show you every grade in the class. Not with names, just so that you knew.
Okay.
And there was one 4.0 and the rest of them were 2.0s or lower. And, you know, so I'm looking at it and I had the 4.0. And I just remember sneaking out of the classroom because they didn't want these English majors. Because people were asking and I was
on your face.
I think, but at the end of the play, he wrote, "You have a lot of talent as a playwright." And I was like, I just never thought about that. And then a couple weeks later in the Michigan State University paper, they were advertising a playwriting competition in the campus. And so I just wrote a full length play, you know, just,
yeah.
And it won. So nice. It was produced at the Wharton Center, and I got to be there for the whole process of it. And I was just like addicted. That whole thing. I mean, it probably wasn't the greatest play in the world, but I loved it. And I loved it so much that at the end of graduation, I had changed my plans. I wasn't looking for a newspaper job. I was looking for a 9-to-5 job that would allow me to write another play. And I think that was quite shocking for my family and a lot of people who knew me, but it really lit something up in me. And so I did. I worked in a law office. 9 to 5.
Writing plays quietly.
Yes, writing plays that went nowhere. So that's how that started. And so I think I grew up as the oldest of 7 children. People read the column probably tired of hearing that line. But when you're oldest of 7, you grow up in conversation. There is no silence. Everyone's in everybody's business. They were big families. And so that's where my ear for dialogue came from. And I loved listening to someone tell a story well. I loved our dinner table conversations. They were just always back and forth and super intense. And all of us were trying to be more witty than the person next to us. So some of them were flat. Some of them were awesome. And so every time when I read stories, I want to feel like I'm eavesdropping in on these characters. And how do you eavesdrop? Yeah. You're listening to a conversation. And so I had a couple of successes with plays afterwards. On Bended Knee was the Pickering Award winner, Down in Cold Water. That was a lot of fun. Those guys were great. And a lot of shorter pieces over in Canton. I had a play done in California. I didn't get to see it, but it was there.
Yeah.
And I did go to New York City and had a 10-minute play included in a festival.
Nice.
Yeah, that was crazy good.
So what is that like when you're sitting back and watching somebody else interpret your work? Is that fun? Is it hard because they've just taken your child and remolded it, or somewhere in between?
It's fascinating, and it is horrifying at times, and wonderful too. I remember the first time I was watching people put the play on for my first play. And I'm sitting there, and the guy was reading the part, and it just wasn't at all the way that character sounded in my head. He was too loud. He was too fast. He was too snarky. And that's just not. And I remember watching him, and afterwards I went out with the assistant director, and we were talking. And he said, "How do you think it's going?" And I said, "Well, how long are you going to let him do it like that?" And he was looking at me, and I go, because, you know, when I did my spiel, and he was so kind, he looked at me and said, "Remember, it's a collaborative project, and the actor is finding his voice in this character. And if it's really off the mark, we'll rein it in." He's like, "But it's early." And it's so funny, because I ended up, out of all the people in that play, that guy was probably my favorite and did an amazing job with that character. But my first impression of it was, so I mean, it's. Despite that, though, I do love watching people have different takes. I mean, by the same token, I've had actors deliver lines in ways where I was like, you know, I wasn't thinking about it said in that manner, but it works so well. To the point that I think one time I took a script and actually changed a little bit of the dialogue. So it's humbling, and it's amazing. And it also makes you realize that even as a creator, your perspective isn't the only perspective. You know, sometimes we don't know what we're doing or what we're creating. It always surprises me what somebody gets out of something. And privately, I think, wow, that's brilliant, but I didn't intend that to happen.
Or interprets it completely differently.
And
they have every right to.
Right.
You let it go and let it have its adult life on its very own.
That's right. It is a lot like raising kids. In fact, writing is an awful lot like having kids.
Labor pains and the whole thing.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I understand that when this is your first novel, A Teacher Named Faith.
First published novel.
Good point. There's probably 10 in the drawer.
Oh, yeah.
Did it start from a writer's block when you were working on a play?
The play On Bended Knee, which is a two-act comedy, I was stuck. And I thought, well, I think I might want to play with it the way an author can play with it, where you're kind of omnipotent, you have control over everything. And very, very quickly, it went in a completely different direction. Although there is some comedic aspects to this novel, it's certainly not what you would call a comedy. And then it just took on a life of its own. So, like I said, when you open it with, at the time, this had changed, but it opened on the morning of 9/11, I was, obviously, we're not going to a comedy, so.
And that takes some courage right there, because 9/11 is such a huge event in American history, and it's been written about and talked about and covered in so many ways. To take that on, that's got to take some courage, too. How can I do this in a new way, in a different way, in a way that will reveal yet another perspective?
It does take a lot of courage. And if you don't ever think the novel's going to see the light of day, you can play all day long in whatever you want to do. And obviously 9/11 affected everybody very deeply. I mean, I was a new mom with my youngest was only 3 weeks old. And I mean, I'll never, ever, ever, ever forget it. Very wisely, when Kern Press made the offer of publication, they had a couple of global edits, which was big, big changes. And they wanted 9/11, the actual happening on 9/11, not to happen. They wanted to remove it a step. And
yeah,
I was upset inside because I had done so much research. I was so careful. I watched and read and, you know, so there's that part. But I said, you know, I'm not Tom Clancy. I don't know how to replace a terrorist event, you know. And the story wasn't about 9/11. It was about these control freaks and the chaos that kind of saves them from themselves. And a terrorist attack is that great big loss of control for everybody. And using it allowed me to set the tone. I didn't have to explain 9/11 to anybody.
Right.
If
it
say
just kind of opens up on that and then brings in some fictional elements.
Absolutely. And so I had made that argument back and they said, yes, exactly. It's not a story about 9/11. And
true.
I kind of soldiered on, and about the middle of chapter 5, I realized that they were just brilliant. That was exactly right. It allowed the story to be what it was.
Yeah.
And but if you read the beginning of the book, it's the anniversary, one anniversary passed. And but yes, I was very affected by that.
So I'm going to ask you to give us a synopsis without giving away what happens. And maybe one way to do that is to tell us about the characters. Who are the main players in this story?
The main player is Saul Thorne. He's a Detroit political cartoonist for Detroit paper. And he decides he's not going into work on the anniversary of 9/11 because he's a little bit of a cynical guy and he's done with the retrospection and the patriotism and everything kind of looking the same. And in the morning he sees, you know, he's still consuming news because that's who he is. And there is a terrorist event that happens, a smaller one, and he has to come back into work, basically. He has a very tortured relationship with pretty much everyone in his life. So unbeknownst to him, his twin brother, who has been in and out of seminaries his whole life, was flying home that day and is in Detroit. And he had just left a seminary. Unknown to his family, he's going to propose to a former girlfriend. Those two lives are the ones that I'm most concerned with. And when this terrorist event happens, both of them get kind of pulled into the public light. Saul ends up creating this political cartoon that called The Teacher Named Faith, which there's an illustration on the cover of the book, but basically it kind of captures national attention on this event. It's very different. His brother happens to be in the airport when the explosion happens in Detroit Metro Airport. He's not on the plane, but he sees it.
Right.
And he has this moment where he just drops into prayer, basically. And he doesn't know it at the time, but he's having his picture taken. And it ends up being splashed over the newspapers. And so what this kind of opens up is they're starting to look at events in their lives, things that they're controlling, things that they want. I think like most of us, when things get out of control, we try to micromanage every aspect. So Simon is going to get married. That's going to fix his problems. And meanwhile, this marriage keeps spiraling out of his hands, this engagement, to the point where it actually breaks. And Saul is looking to get out. His girlfriend is Faith. She's been his girlfriend his whole life. He hasn't had any other girlfriend. But they don't exactly have a very typical relationship. Saul has a strange relationship with his father, and so has what we'd like to call a marriage aversion. But he loves her and she loves him. So
now you've also referred to this this book, to writing in your first, I think it might have been one of your first readings at Battle Creek Books. You talked about it being your beautiful burden, which I thought was kind of neat. And you talked about it being something very close to you, but at the same time that it terrifies you.
The book involves a lot of aspects. Obviously, there's it kind of lays you bare, you know, and especially when you write a column, I think people that read you kind of have an assumption about who you are, who they think you are. It's funny, I write a column about my family life and I'm actually a very private person and I'm very much an introvert. And so when you create, you just go into everywhere and all of a sudden it's all out there for everybody to see. And, you know, there's an aspect about control versus faith. And I have, you know, my journey that I'm on, just like everybody else is on. And I'm very careful in that realm. You know, I wanted to tell a story first.
Yeah.
That was very important to me. What you get out of it or don't get out of it. If nothing else, I want you to walk away and say, hey, I was entertained or that was a good story. It might spark some deeper thinking, but it just makes you, you know, when I read a story and something moves me, I start thinking about the writer for the first time. It's funny. I never read author biographies or anything. I don't Google them. If you touch me, then I'll go on Google and then I'll want to know how you tick and also what else you think. And so basically it's a massive invasion of privacy. And so it's
writing is like that. You're right. It's very naked. You're standing out on that stage. And even if you're, I've always said, even if you're writing science fiction, you're still revealing who you are, your value system, how you perceive things by who you choose as your good guys and your bad guys.
Oh yeah. You know, and it's funny cause it is fiction. It is, you know, putting your life experience and your thoughts and your dreams and your questions in a crock pot and then, you know, basically drinking it afterwards. And, you know, so the part of me that used to dance ballet, you know, Faith is a ballerina and little aspects of my training kind of cooked in that crock pot or my time in and out of the newsroom, you know, also sitting there in the, you know, and and the first thing people ask you is this about you? Is this about this person? Is this about that person? And I understand why you think that, but it's not, and I get worried and I get protective, I guess.
And yet, it is.
Of course it is. Of course it is. It's all sorts of aspects, but I mean, I wanted to entertain and I just wanted to put something out there, things that I think about. I mean, I am the ultimate control freak and I am a faithful person, but I'll be honest, I'm a much better control freak than I am a faithful person. Letting go of the book was a big exercise in control.
You know, I never thought of it that way, Nicole, but, you know, writers probably are control freaks.
Oh, they're probably the worst.
We're creating our own worlds, and we get to move around these... You're kind of playing God, aren't you? I mean, you
for sure you are.
Your own little universe there.
Although it's so funny, also another lesson of playing God, or maybe it kind of gave me an interesting perspective in prayer life and God, because my characters quickly took over the place and were calling the shots or wanting to call the shots.
Well,
sometimes
you know,
I had to wrestle
you've got
the plot.
Success when that happens, when they start talking for themselves.
Oh, yes. Yes. And you feel like they're in your home. And for example, I do miss them. I mean, as much as I labored on it and met deadlines with it and agonized over it, people ask me, oh, are you going to write a sequel? And I thought, I don't really know where a sequel would happen in the book. But I can understand why people go back for sequels. You just want to, you know, invite your friends over again and be like, hey, what's going on now?
So what do you think? Well, it's not your first novel. It's your first published novel. What do you think you learned from this experience?
Loads.
Yeah?
Loads. A lot. I am very blessed with, I have a very wonderful first reader, very tough personal editor, and the column work. Well, actually, the first novel I wrote, the one that's not going anywhere, was the first project we worked on together. And she was so harsh, but so truthful.
Yeah.
And what I loved about her is that she understood what I was doing. And she never did any editing like, hey, you could say it this way. She just said, this is where it goes off the rails. This is where I don't, you know. And
then let you fix it.
Yep. Every week we go through the column. I don't know if people know this, but when they give me a compliment on the column, I always think she deserves part of the credit. Because every week we go through those columns. And every week she holds my feet to the fire. And it really made me appreciate editors. And then when the book was accepted for publication, you know, her and I had edited the book, I mean, 3-4 times.
Yeah.
And in my mind, it was done. And then the publisher comes on board.
Starts all over again.
And yes. And I found myself, and I didn't know them as well as I know her. So part of me was like, well, you know, you get inside, you're defensive. But like I said, for me, it was a big epiphany when they asked for this change. Giving up 9/11 was very tough for me. When I got to the point where I realized how lazy I was being by using this as a crutch,
yeah,
and how the prose got sharper and tighter and better, and the people were, writing feels very solitary, but honestly, it really is just the first part. Those gatekeepers, those editors, they are so important. And I feel bad in this world because I feel like we're cutting this group of people out. Everyone can fast track to instant. And I don't want to be harsh about it. And for some people, that's all they want. They want to see it in print, and that's enough for them. I have this really weird old, like, I wanted a traditional publisher. I wanted a book in my hand, and I
because
wanted editors.
Editing.
Yes. Yeah. I always joke I'm going to get a shirt that says gatekeepers have approved of me, but it was really important to get through the gatekeepers.
Writing, telling a story, and being a good editor, it's a very different skill set.
And I don't know if I would be a good editor. I mean, there are some people that are just gifted at looking at someone else's work and saying, I love it, and this is where it's not complete, or this is where you didn't follow through.
Yeah.
Or maybe even saying, this isn't worth your time. And it's tough because I wouldn't listen to just anybody. You have to get that trusted person,
yeah,
that understands what you're doing. Because
and you still have that inner voice in you. I mean, you know, not every editor can be on the mark either. I mean, now and then you probably found yourself in a struggle with an editor and say, you know what? My gut tells me this belongs. Did that happen?
Yeah. Like I said, I've been very fortunate. Just the right people have been around at the right time. And like I said, they're very tough. And I'm not saying I haven't cried over things being taken out. And I haven't argued for things to stay in. And sometimes I win and sometimes I lose. But I find more often than not, I'm so close to my project that I really don't have an honest perspective on what works or doesn't work. They are. They're my beautiful darlings.
Yeah.
And, you know, just like when someone says something's wrong with your kid, your first reaction is, step off. You know, and then you say, is there some truth to this? You know, and you have that thought process afterwards. So
the metaphor keeps working. Children and our creative children. You know?
Right, right.
So are you right now enjoying the journey with the newly published book? Or are you already working on another project or projects?
There's always, I mean, if you can't tell, I have so many. You know, there's my column work, and I'm almost done with another play. I'm trying to see how that goes. And of course, you know, there's always a book. There's always, I'm always working. And sometimes I wish I had a more narrow focus so that it was easier. But
do you think there'll be another novel soon? Or
I don't know. I joked at my book reading when someone asked me this. When you deliver a baby and someone comes into the hospital and they're like, oh, are you going to have another one? And there you are, you're bleeding and you're like, no, I don't think so.
Once it's in its potty trained, then we'll ask you. Okay.
No, and I'm trying to get the book out there. My press is wonderful, supportive. They did a great job, but, you know, it's a small press. So, you know, things like this are so important. And
And so tell me about the cover of the novel.
One of the changes is A Teacher Named Faith was not the title of the book. That was one of the global changes. And I kind of figured they would change the title. When we settled on this title, though, I was real nervous.
I have to ask, what was the original title?
It was just their last name, Thorne. It was probably a working title, I figured. And it was funny. I think the publisher pulled up like five books that had the title, which was fine. It wasn't that. I was hesitating on the title, and actually A Teacher Named Faith is the caption that Saul Thorne puts on the cartoon. And so the problem is when you see that title, this is the control freak in me. I didn't want this entire thought process, people putting it together, deciding it's a nonfiction spiritual testimonial of some kind. And so I was really nervous, even though in many, many, many ways it's the perfect title for the book. I was obsessed with having an illustration on the cover because two reasons. One, I wanted a representation of the cartoon on the cover. And two, I just wanted to confuse people when they picked up the book. I didn't, if they pick it up and you see a teacher named Faith and you're starting to think, is this some type of Christian fiction? And then you look at this picture of a ballerina and there's a cityscape and there's smoke coming up. You'll at least be confused enough to turn the book over. And
good thinking.
Initially, the publisher, they did photographs and I had to, that's where I used my begging and succeeded. And I had a wonderful illustrator who was willing to recreate her interpretation of the cartoon, and it worked. And we went through several versions, but I'm very pleased to see it there. And if you get through chapter one, you'll understand why the cover is the way it is. So,
yeah.
But I had one reader tell me when she was finished with the book, she was really enthusiastic about enjoying it, and she said, "I just love the cover. It's like having a piece of salt." And I just thought that was interesting because, yeah, if you're thinking about stuff in the book and you close it, you should have this remembrance of what kind of plunged these characters into all this chaos to begin with. And so I was very, very pleased with it.
And the illustrator is?
The illustrator is Lori Ann O'Neill, and she lives in Nederland, Colorado.
So is this someone you know, a friend, or your publisher found her?
Nope, I found her. And yes, you could say she's a friend. She's my best friend. She's my sister.
Oh, that is the best friend.
And I pushed very hard for her to do it. She said she couldn't. She was one of the first readers of the book and was got it. And she was willing to do it. And we went through a couple arguments, shall we say. And it turned out
great.
As
sisters can.
Yes. Her brainchild. So I appreciate it.